Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Deng-Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, June 7th, 2018. Ambassador Hushuk says the only way a South Sudan peace deal will work is if everybody is included.
What is clear is that if there is to be a revitalized agreement, it needs to be inclusive and so that it has a chance of taking hold and people respecting it.
And MSF says fighting is out of control in South Sudan's Leer and Mayandit counties.
The population are generally caught between the front lines where fighting is occurring, and it's difficult for them to get to the areas where we can actually access safely. So this is the biggest problem that we are seeing.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The new U.S. ambassador to South Sudan, Thomas Hushuk, has denied accusations that the U.S. government is behind efforts to keep former First Vice President Riek Machar in exile and to block him from taking part in talks to revitalize the 2015 peace deal. In part two of an exclusive interview with South Sudan in Focus, Hushuk says the talks should be inclusive so that their outcome is respected by all the warring parties, including Riek Machar's.
Well, when the announcement almost a year ago was made that they were going to pursue revitalization of the peace agreement, one of the clear markers that we and others put down was that this needs to be inclusive talks. Riek Machar's party, of course, was represented at the talks. He himself wasn't there in person, but his party was there. What is clear is that if there is to be a revitalized agreement, it needs to be inclusive and so that it has a chance of taking hold and people respecting it. There was this interim part of this process where a cessation of hostilities agreement was signed by all parties again. And unfortunately, it was also ignored by all parties, and there have been many violations of it. So we would hope that there will be consequences for the people that have been violating the agreement, the cessation of hostilities agreement, and for others who have blocked progress in the peace talks in general.
Some people in the opposition, especially the SPLM in opposition, have accused the U.S. government of being behind the exiling of the rebel leader and also being behind efforts to block him from participating in the talks. Your comment on that?
Yeah, I've only been here 3 days, and already I've heard accusations both that we, like you mentioned, that we are on the government side against the opposition and that we are on the opposition side against the government. But I think if you look at our record, we're very consistent. We are against those who are obstructing the peace process, and we are for anyone who can contribute and will contribute to the peace process.
Are the U.S. government and other members of the international community discussing any alternative form of government and not a transitional government of national unity in case the parties do not reach a peace deal?
Well, the exact outlines of the future of the governing structures here and the security structures, those are the two big areas that have been under discussion. The outlines of those depend on the parties in the discussions, what they can agree on and uphold after they sign on the bottom line. We certainly have some thoughts on some particulars, but the future shape of this government will depend on the parties. Yes, it looked there. We do think that it's premature to hold elections in this country right now. With so many people that are displaced away from their homes outside the country, there's more than 2 million refugees right now. There are people that are fearing for their life and their immediate security. It is not ripe for a free, fair, and accurate election at this time. So that's one of the things we said. So that argues that there will probably be some kind of transitional arrangement after the current terms of the current peace agreement do expire. But the exact outlines of that are still not determined, are up to the parties in the discussions.
The U.S. government last month announced that it would carry out a review of its assistance to South Sudan. Isn't this a move that is likely to worsen the humanitarian situation and hurt civilians who have nothing to do with the fighting and the conflict?
Well, that's certainly not the intention. The review is something, in fact, we review our programs and our budgetary assistance all over the world all the time, because every year, you know, we have to justify what programs we're funding. But this is a special review. The U.S. has provided over $3 billion in humanitarian assistance alone to South Sudan and South Sudanese people just since the conflict began. And this represents American taxpayers, a little old lady in my home state of Wisconsin reaching into her purse to pay taxes. And people are in America are generous of heart, and they want to make sure that some of that tax money does go to do humanitarian programs. But also, we want to make sure that the money is used in a way that does what it's intended for, which is to save lives, not fuel the conflict. So we're looking closely at how our assistance is delivered and making sure that it's as efficient as possible, it's even-handed, it's not used to politicize the crisis or the conflict. And this is the nature of the review.
That is the new U.S. ambassador to South Sudan, Thomas Hushek, speaking to editor and reporter Charlton Doki in Juba. A sharp escalation in fighting and attacks on civilians in the Leer and Mayendid counties in South Sudan have forced thousands of people to flee for their lives, according to the French organization Doctors Without Borders. While not assigning blame for atrocities committed against civilians, Georgina Brown, MSF's medical coordinator, is calling on all armed actors to stop the violence against civilians, which include sexual violence, looting and burning of villages.
What we are seeing, because people don't have access to healthcare, they have no shelter, no food, no drinkable water, we see a lot of an increase in thyroid diseases, pneumonia, obviously skin infections, and of course the number of cases of sexual violence we see is also alarmingly high.
You mentioned issues with access and safety for humanitarians as well. Do you have any more details, or could you give us a better idea of exactly what's going on as far as getting access to these places for your humanitarian workers?
Yeah, so I mean, it's not just access for humanitarian workers; it's also like access for the population as well. So the population are generally caught between the front lines where fighting is occurring. And it's difficult for them to get to the areas where we can actually access safely. So this is the biggest problem that we are seeing. So what we're calling on is for all armed actors to immediately put an end to the violence against the local populations in Leer and Mayendit counties, and allow safe access to humanitarian medical organizations to get to these populations and give essential medical care.
A famine was declared in both Leer and Mayendit last year, which was ultimately lifted.
Yeah.
But have food security conditions gotten any better since then?
I mean, it's very difficult to make that assessment. We have very few people on the ground who can give us information. And as the population is moving, it's really hard to do an assessment of what the nutrition status is of the population. But obviously we know that homes have been destroyed, people have had to flee, they've lost their livelihoods. We know they don't have enough access to food or clean water, so we know this is going to be an ongoing big issue for this population.
What types of resources do civilians in both counties have? I mean, what options do they have in this particular situation?
So they have very, very few options, actually. They are living in swamp areas, because this is the area where they feel they have no safety. But living conditions are very poor. This is why we see the increase in thyroid diseases and skin diseases. And they don't have access to life-saving care. So any complications due to pregnancy or any severe injuries, it's really difficult to get access to this population and to evacuate them to a higher facility for medical care. It's very difficult for them.
The press release also says that survivors have told MSF of instances of gang rapes, mass killings, villages looted. Have they told you who is doing this?
So obviously our main concern is the treatment, medical treatment for the population affected. And obviously we are seeing a lot of cases of sexual violence. And yes, of course, we listen to what people say. But our interest is primarily to provide medical care, and we don't want to get into the situation of blaming one party against the other. We just want to have access to this population.
That was Georgina Brown, MSF's medical coordinator in South Sudan, who spoke to me from Juba. Families who lost loved ones in what's known as the Juba Massacre of 1992 say they want their fallen relatives to be recognized as war heroes. They also want a memorial built for them. The government of Sudan executed hundreds of South Sudanese army soldiers, policemen, and civilians within a two-month period in 1992 in connection with an attack on Juba by then SPLA rebels. Yesterday, dozens of widows and orphans gathered at Juba's Nyakrun Cultural Center to commemorate the fallen men and women who fought for an independent South Sudan, as we hear from Nabil Biagio in Juba.
The events of June and July of 1992 followed a major attack by the Sudan People's Liberation Army, who were fighting the Sudan government at the time. After the attack on what is now the South Sudanese capital, the Sudan government ordered the arrest of dozens of Southern Sudanese suspected of being SPLA collaborators. 26-year-old Stephen Mark is the third son of Taban Mark, a prison officer who disappeared in 1992. Mark says his father was taken away before he was born.
What I heard from my mom is that one day my father went to work as he normally goes. Then a short while after he came back, soldiers came to the house. They knocked the door. Then he opened. They said that he should go to Giada, which was the military barrack. Then he came back to my mom and he said, "You take care of these kids. I'm going. I might not come back."
Mark says his mother never saw his father again. Speaking while fighting back tears, he says his mother had to struggle to make ends meet while raising him and two siblings. Although he never saw his dad, Mark says, he knows him from what other people have told him.
My father was a very loving person. He loved my mom. He loved my mom so much, and he loved my two big brothers who were there. One of the painful things to grow up without a father. Not just that, but to grow up with such memories when you go everywhere. The stories you hear about your father. People tell you so many things about your father, but you haven't experienced those things.
Eunice Gordon Wani says she too lost her husband in 1992. She says her husband, Michael Ladu Lobuju Laki, worked as a government administrative officer. Wani says the government owes it to the families of the men who made the ultimate sacrifice to officially recognize them as heroes.
We are just asking that these people be memorialized so that their children do not forget them. We need the government to allocate us a place where such a memorial can be built.
Wani says the government must also care for the orphans and widows who have been left behind. Hafsa Dahia is chairperson of the Widows and Orphans Association, which was established in 2009 by the families of the victims. She too lost her husband in 1992 and says the association has drafted plans to help the families of the war heroes, but it lacks funding.
In the coming period, the association would like to invest new policies, train widows and orphans, those of special needs, and empower them with capacity building.
Speaking at the same event organized by Dahia's group, Jubek State Minister of Gender, Child and Social Welfare, Rose Liso Polino, told the families that the state officials are committed to supporting them.
Today, we are celebrating, recognizing all the efforts of your husbands, beloved ones.
Polino says more than 380 people went missing in connection with the Juba massacre. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. Coming up, a former deputy governor in South Sudan is accusing security operatives of confiscating his property. More on that when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What traditional medicines do you take, if any?
I don't take any traditional medicine as a young, active African. I think I'm strong enough. I use water and more of the fruits. I think my parents do a lot of traditional medicine.
I haven't taken traditional medicine yet. I hope I never do, because I'm biased about traditional medicine. I think people put in so much spiritual things to make sure that their medicine works, so I've not given it a try.
Yeah, I take, but I don't know the biological names in English. Yeah, but I take that is this Mururuza. I don't know how they call it in English. And the aloe vera tigaji. Yeah, I take Mururuza and the aloe vera for treatment of malaria. Very good. Most of myself, I use it so much, too much.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The former deputy governor of Terrakeka State, who joined the rebel South Sudan United Front, says his personal assets were taken by security operatives this week. Clement Maring accuses the governor of Terrakeka and some state ministers of giving instructions to the national security to confiscate his property in Terrakeka and Juba. Maring says even if he has rebelled against the care administration, it's against the law to target his personal assets.
They have confiscated my house. That is my personal house, which is rented by an organization which is responsible for peace and education in the state. And also, they have closed down my shop, which is rented for pharmacy and is serving the people of the state with medication. They attempted also to come to Juba to close down a petrol station along Gudele Road. We combined with a neighbor to rent it out for petrol station. They decided to also close down that petrol station, but I think they did not succeed because the person who is renting the petrol station is related to the boss of the security in Juba.
What prompted the authorities in Terrakeka State to confiscate your house and your shop?
Up to now, I'm not given the important reason why they resorted to confiscate my properties. If it is the issue of opposition, there was somebody who had joined the SPLA-IO before called Ramadan Hassan. He has his house, and his house has never been confiscated during the entire time that he joined the SPLA-IO. And up to now, he returned there. He got his properties there intact. Nobody has touched. So coming to my own property, I think they have their own personal reason that they are now resorting to confiscate my personal properties.
You are a member of the South Sudan United Front. Do you think the officials in Terrakeka States are punishing you for rebelling against South Sudan?
Well, there are so many people who have rebelled against the government. It's not only me. It's not Paul Malong alone. But I don't know whether their properties are taken like that one of mine. What is the point to take a property? Has the property rebelled? The property are there for South Sudan. The property is for beautification of the state. The property is serving the state there. It is an individual. It is the person who have rebelled. If there is any problem, they have to deal it with the individual.
What happened to your clients who were renting this property?
They have been forced to move out from the house, and after now the house is vacated. Even the shop is also under their own security protection. But the shop, the drugs are inside there, and the drugs are really helping the people of the state.
What is your next move, given what happened to your house and your shop in Terrakeka town?
First of all, I'll make their names public, let the world know that there are criminals who are confiscating people's properties. These are the criminals who are actually the government officials who are supposed to protect the people's properties, and they are now the ones actually abusing and misusing their authority to confiscate and to close down people's properties.
Clement Maring is the former deputy governor of Terekeka State. He was speaking to my colleague John Tanza from the Ugandan capital Kampala earlier today. A study by the UN Children's Fund, together with Uganda's Economic Policy Research Center, reveals that both refugees and host communities in Uganda lack basic services like water, sanitation, and shelter. Uganda is home to more than 1.4 million refugees from neighboring countries like South Sudan. The large influx puts a strain on resources everywhere the refugees congregate. Halima Athumani has the story for VOA from Kampala.
The report finds when it comes to basic services such as drinking water, sanitation and shelter, long-term refugees in Uganda and the communities that host them are equally deprived. The report says this is because the main refugee hosting areas such as Yumbe, Moyo, Adjumani, Arua and Isinjiro districts are among the country's poorest and least developed. Ibrahim Kasiri, the principal researcher at the Economic Policy Research Center, notes the issue is one of supply and demand.
The report shows that there are serious challenges in terms of implementation, especially when government plan for a given number of population, and the population that ends up using these services doubles within the same year in which these plans were made. The fact that they've had to deal with that huge number, their level of deprivation has increased.
The report notes that 69% of refugees who have lived in the country more than 5 years don't have enough clean drinking water, while one-fourth lack sanitation and about a half are in need of shelter. For members of host communities, about two-thirds do not have water and close to one-half lack sanitation. Even though Uganda has been praised for its progressive refugee policy, which includes providing the refugees with land on which to put up shelter, Diego Angemi, head of the social policy team at UNICEF Uganda, says this is still a major challenge.
When you look at it from the point of view of integration, and if we believe that adequate shelter is a good proxy for integration, then refugee communities are now perfectly integrated with host communities. But we're still talking about one in two households, whether they are hosts or refugees, being deprived of adequate shelter. And that's simply not good enough.
60% of refugees in Uganda are below the age of 18, and thousands come unaccompanied. According to the report, 70% do not own a blanket, 84% do not eat three meals a day, and nearly one half do not visit a health facility when ill or get the prescription medication needed to treat illnesses. Manga Godfrey, the assistant district health officer in the Adjumani district, says out of five senior medical officers needed, only two are available.
We don't have medical officer, special grade pediatrics, and to us is a big gap. We also need that physician. Our disease burden is mainly malaria, this intestinal worms, dysentery. Now, these two special grade medical officers we have may not help much if the issue of medicines and other health supplies are not addressed. Currently, we are receiving medicines from national medical stores every 2 months, but these medicines are planned for the host communities only, excluding the refugees.
Researchers stress the need for government and international humanitarian organizations to go beyond emergency response and build systems and capacities for all social services in refugee hosting districts. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Despite the adverse conditions at Ugandan camps you just heard about, some refugees not only survive but thrive. A South Sudanese refugee student in Uganda has found himself in the limelight after his outstanding performance in the Ugandan Advanced Certificate of Education, or University Entrance Exams, along with his performance in the prestigious Makerere University's College of Law pre-entry exams. Simon Peter Apiku has the details for VOA from Kampala, Uganda.
21-year-old Daniel Makwe began his primary school education at the Kakuma refugee camp. In 2008, his family came to Uganda, where he completed his primary education, scoring first grade with an aggregate of 4 in the primary living examinations. Makwe was admitted to King's College Budo. After 4 years, he sat for his Uganda Certificate of Education examinations and again passed in the first grade. Last year, Makwei joined the Green Hill Academy for Advanced Education, where he also finished in the first grade. This year, he was accepted into Makerere University's College of Law. Makwei came in first out of the 860 students who passed.
I worked hard and I was committed to my work, and yeah, I sort of expected great academic work for myself.
Makwei's former head teacher at the Green Hill Academy, Francis Twesigawe, recalls how he first met Makwei.
He had done his O-level in King's College, Budo, and then he had the financial constraint as he was starting senior five, and got a school somewhere in Matuga. Don't recall the school very well. Got a school in Matuga. Then later, I think the guardians and the parents recovered and got some finances. So that's when he came in now, entering senior six.
Makwei says in December 2013, his family decided to go back to South Sudan for Christmas. Just a few days later, conflict broke out in the capital, Juba, and quickly spread to other parts of the country, forcing the family to abruptly end their visit and return to Uganda, where they registered as refugees. Economic conditions worsened, and Makwei says that meant obtaining school fees became an uphill battle for his father, who had remained in Juba.
My father always found a way out in all the hard situations. He has a value for education, and he has struggled very hard. He has always made sure we go to school on time, that we have all our needs on time, and also with the help of other relatives.
Twesigawe says despite the challenges he faced, Makwei not only remained focused on his studies, but he also inspired other students to work hard.
He was confident, very, very confident, and hardworking. He was one of the hardworking boys that we had. And because of his hardworking character, he started attracting other children. He would encourage them to read, he would encourage them to extend for 1 more hour in the dormitory. He would encourage them to form discussions, and he would always tell them, life is hard. I've passed through hard and complicated life, so it's the bread that will make my future.
Makwei says he expects to start his university studies in August, but he already has a clear idea what he wants after graduating from law school.
I would want to see that people are treated fairly, equally, and that everyone has the same kind of treatment when it comes to the courts, and I would want to see the rule of law enforced everywhere, particularly in my country, where crimes have been committed with impunity.
Makwei says he is still not sure if his father, who also has other children to support, will be able to pay his university tuition. Although he remains hopeful things will work out. His former head teacher Twesigawe says the school now plans to invite the 21-year-old man to give talks to students on various topics such as confidence building and his personal study techniques. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
And that's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Gutamiza with Radio and Weasel featuring B2C. We've been listening to A Taste of Radio and Weasel featuring B2C with the song Gutamiza. I'm Ayen Dang Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. How did you like the show? Let us know what you think. You can find us on the web at southsudan@voanews.com or reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm a busy
katawanya. I wanna feel your body, tattoo your name on my face. You're so tempting. But even close, I come like a smile on my face.